The next case this morning is 522-0088, People versus Williams. Arguing for the defendant appellant is Elizabeth Cook. Arguing for the state appellee is Hiram Fenjack. Each side will have 10 minutes for their argument. The appellant will also have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please note only the clerk is permitted to record these proceedings today.
Good morning, counsel. Apologize, our last two cases took a little longer than we expected, so we appreciate your patience. Ms. Cook, are you ready to proceed?
I am, thank you, Your Honor.
Then go right ahead.
May it please the court. I would like to focus this morning on the first three arguments. The first two relate to Calvin's request for a new trial, and the third relates to his request for a remand for further Krankel proceedings. Calvin Williams did not receive a fair trial. The compounded errors made by the trial court, the state, and defense counsel all deprived Calvin of his right to present a defense and have the jury consider only competent evidence. Calvin's one-time friend and confidant, Paula Moore, was allowed to present inflammatory and unreliable hearsay testimony over repeated objections by defense counsel. The state has conceded that Moore's testimony included inadmissible hearsay. Moore told the jury that the victim, Geriante Brown, did not own a gun and that she told Calvin the same. This evidence served to discredit Calvin's ultimate defense, which was that he believed, either reasonably or not, that Geriante was armed and a threat to him. In addition, Moore's hearsay evidence suggested a motive for the shooting when she stated that Geriante and Calvin had had a dispute over missing money and that in consequence, Geriante had received videos from Calvin that he perceived as threatening. Moore's testimony concerned matters of which she had no firsthand knowledge because she was not present during the dispute about the money, had not seen any of the allegedly threatening videos or messages, and had no way of knowing whether Geriante in fact did possess a gun but had not told her about it. Thus, the admission of this testimony should not be considered harmless error, and Calvin is entitled to a new trial on this basis. Next, the court permitted lead detective Jody Cherry to sit at counsel table for the duration of trial and serve as a cleanup crew for the prosecution. Excuse me, Your Honor. Cherry was the final witness called in the state's case in chief, meaning that he heard the evidence of all of the other witnesses, which included 9 adolescents, and was then positioned to fill in gaps and clear up ambiguities for the jury through his own testimony. This case did not have complicated or technical facts, which the state's attorney would need assistance in presenting to the jury. Aside from claiming Cherry as its designated representative under Rule 615(2), the state provided no justification for Cherry's presence for the duration of trial. This practice is a departure from the longstanding routine of allowing motions to exclude. The state's representative is the state's attorney. The interests of fairness to both parties and the policy interest of conserving police resources do not support allowing a lead detective to take an additional role in a prosecution. A police officer is a figure of authority, and his testimony may be prejudicial if he informs the jury that they should believe the prosecution's case. In Calvin's case, Cherry did just that with respect to 3 different types of evidence, all of which went to Calvin's ultimate defense. First, no witness saw Geriante get shot, and the home surveillance cameras did not record the moment of his shooting. Yet Cherry repeatedly told the jury that he had never seen Geriante with a gun after viewing these videos multiple times. Cherry's words had the authority of law enforcement behind them, even though there was no way to know from the videos whether Geriante stood in front of the window with the form of a weapon visible, as Calvin testified and as Whitfield stated in his custodial interview. For the state, there was a frustrating absence of documentary evidence on this key moment, and Cherry was there to fill in the gap. Viewing the home surveillance videos makes it readily apparent that no witness interpretation was necessary. The videos were taken from a single camera positioned at a single angle with a view to an ordinary household kitchen, and little activity actually occurs within view of the camera, save for a few of the teenagers moving in and out of view. Cherry's testimony was not required to aid the jury in their understanding, and Cherry had no personal knowledge of the people or events depicted in the videos. Simply put, Cherry should not have narrated these videos, and his doing so contravened the rules of evidence and contributed to the prejudice resulting from his continual presence throughout Calvin's trial. Second, Cherry similarly functioned as the gap filler when he explicated the Facebook message exchange between Geriante and Calvin over Calvin's missing money. Here, Calvin was prejudiced because Cherry's testimony served to magnify this dispute in the minds of the jurors. And once again, Cherry's testimony was not supported by any established rule of evidence. Cherry was not qualified as an expert in adolescent social media slang, and nor was one necessary because the Facebook conversation was one the jury was fully capable of deciphering. Third, Cherry's cleanup crew came through again when he attempted to reconcile the inconsistencies in Whitfield Harris's testimony. Whitfield's in-court testimony contradicted that in his custodial statement on two key points: whether he could see someone in Geriante's house holding an object that looked like a gun, and whether he heard return fire. Shortly after his arrest, Whitfield told Cherry that inside Geriante's house, he saw a long shadowy figure that looked like a gun. However, at Calvin's trial, Whitfield stated that he did not recall telling the police this. Similarly, during his custodial interview, Whitfield told Cherry that after Calvin shot, they shot back. Whitfield said that people from Geriante's house ran outside after Calvin shot at the house, and they fired 5 or 6 times at him and Calvin as they ran away. Yet, at Calvin's trial, Whitfield stated that he was not sure if he had heard return fire. In his testimony, Cherry improperly attempted to rehabilitate Whitfield by presenting his own highly speculative account of what Whitfield was thinking at the time he gave the statement and why his answers at trial differed. In so doing, Cherry discredited the beneficial parts of Whitfield's account in the eyes of the jury and attempted to simplify and smooth over his contradictory narrative. These errors rendered Calvin's jury trial fundamentally unfair. The state was allowed to elevate Cherry throughout its prosecution, sitting him at counsel table where the jury and all of the teenage witnesses could see him and where he could listen to each witness's account and then fill in gaps during his own testimony. Calvin's trial was not helped by the ineffective assistance of defense counsel, who literally and figuratively fell asleep at counsel table. Counsel admitted that she nodded off during a portion of Calvin's trial, a fact that may have been as observable to the jury as it was to Calvin himself.
Don't mean to stop you there, counsel, but if I'm recalling from my reading, there were two attorneys at defense counsel table, correct?
Yes, you're right, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel also failed to zealously pursue Calvin's defense. Although counsel knew of a witness, James Mann, who had been interviewed by police and who said he heard at least 2 types of gunfire, counsel never sought to present him as a witness. This was despite the fact that the crux of Calvin's defense was that he believed someone in Geriante's house was going to shoot him and that he heard gunshots coming from Geriante's house after he fired. Similarly, counsel failed to introduce images of Geriante holding guns, which had been obtained in discovery and which the trial court had ruled would be admissible as impeachment evidence. After Paula Moore testified that Geriante did not have a gun, such evidence would have served both to discredit her and to provide direct support for Calvin's affirmative defense. Yet counsel made no effort to admit these images at trial. Even prior to
Wasn't that somewhat of a trial strategy, given the fact that the trial court said that if he wanted to use those photographs, then it would open the door for any photographs of your client holding guns to be admitted as well?
Correct, Your Honor. That is what the trial court ruled. However, we would argue that those images would not have been so prejudicial as to warrant excluding similar images of the victim holding guns, simply because Calvin never denied that he had guns. And the jury had already heard this testimony from Paula Moore about guns that Calvin possessed.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is, and this is why I'm characterizing, isn't that a strategy decision that trial counsel made at the time? And now in hindsight, obviously it may have been a bad decision, but do we correct that for them now?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the evidence potentially went right to the heart of Calvin's defense, and that he did not have, aside from his own testimony, direct evidence that Geriante did in fact own a gun. And showing these images would have provided evidence that went right to the heart of his defense. Just one more thought. Even prior to trial, defense counsel failed to protect Calvin's constitutional rights. Calvin's custodial statement should have been suppressed because he explicitly invoked his right to counsel during interrogation. Had defense counsel properly sought to suppress this statement, Calvin would not have faced the prejudice of his jury seeing him in an interrogation cell, struggling to focus due to the effect of a substance he had taken. Instead, he could have been able to provide his account to the jury his credibility untarnished by this sight. At every turn, Calvin's constitutional right to a fair trial was infringed by the court, the state, and defense counsel. Calvin requests that this court reverse his conviction and remand for a new trial or grant the alternative relief requested in his briefs. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. Before we move on to Mr. Finjak, Justice Vaughn or Justice Barberis, do you have any questions?
No.
The ineffective assistance of counsel claim, is your allegation of error that the court failed to appoint new counsel for him, or what's the basis of your error there?
That's right, Your Honor. Our claim is being raised in the context of Calvin's pro se Krankel motion. And we're arguing that he met the standard of possible neglect warranting new counsel to investigate and hold an evidentiary hearing on these allegations.
Is that the man testimony and the gun testimony, or?
Yes, you're right. Yes.
The attorney falling asleep, but you're not putting as much stock in that, because as Justice Bowie pointed out, there were two attorneys there. And my memory is the attorney never really admitted she fell asleep. She said she'd closed her eyes, but it was during the playing of a video, so there was no one to cross-examine anyway. Is that
Your
right?
Honor, yes, that is what she stated. However, that was not Calvin's recollection of the timing of when she fell asleep. And in any case, this is exactly the type of issue that could be further developed with the assistance of counsel at an evidentiary hearing.
Well, I'm certainly not condoning sleeping during trial, but as Justice Bowie points out, if there was another attorney there representing, how was the defendant prejudiced or how was the defendant harmed if he had representation that was on the job, at the wheel, whatever you want to say? His rights were being protected because there was at least one attorney there wide awake and paying attention.
Yes, Your Honor, but he had been appointed two attorneys because two were necessary in a murder trial such as this. And the attorney who fell asleep was taking more of the role of lead counsel in this case, conducting more of the witness examinations and the closing argument. And her missing out on what could have been essential testimony was certainly prejudicial to her ability to resume his defense.
But it wasn't really testimony, it was the playing of a video. So, I mean, there was no one to cross-examine. Presumably she'd seen the video before. So I'm not sure how that in and of itself rises to the level.
Well, Your Honor, Calvin testified that it didn't occur during recorded video. It occurred during live testimony. And to my recollection, the other attorney who was representing Calvin was not present during the preliminary inquiry into his Krankel motion. And so he did not weigh in on when this sleeping might have occurred.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. Mr. Finjak, go right ahead with your argument. You're muted. If you could unmute for us, please.
All right, thank you, Your Honor. First, as respect to Paula Moore's testimony, she testified to the existence of a dispute between the defendant and the victim over the missing money. But we would argue that one of the factors in a harmless analysis is whether the evidence was cumulative. There was lots of evidence in this trial that there had been a dispute over the money. As far as her testimony that the defendant had, or the victim had told her, the defendant had sent her, that the victim had told Moore that the defendant had sent him threatening images, that's not what tipped the scales as far as the defendant's conviction. The defendant was convicted based on overwhelming evidence, primarily to do with the fact that he sought out his former friend's house, traveled to the house, lurked around in the backyard and ended up firing multiple rounds into the house, killing the victim. As far as Cherry's presence, the case law said that the mere presence of a detective, a law enforcement official throughout the trial is not in and of itself enough to establish prejudice. the defendant argues that his presence allowed him to shape his testimony. I don't think there's any evidence to support that. As far as his testimony on the video, he confined his testimony to what he observed. He never said that the victim never had a gun, period. He said that in the video, you can see that there's no gun that appears in the victim's hand or anywhere in the recording. And one of the factors in whether it's appropriate for a witness to narrate a video is whether it's helpful to the jury. I believe that's the Thompson case. And here it obviously was helpful. The jury doesn't have the luxury like the detective did, or like we do who have the record, to, you know, rewatch the video over and over again, stop it, you know, closely look at what's occurring. So his narration serves to help the jury see what's happening. It, you know, and the whole point of him saying that you couldn't see a gun there, I mean, obviously that is circumstantial evidence that the victim was not armed at all. And the jury could reasonably infer that. The jury could also infer that, as the defendant has argued, a gun is easy to hide. The jury could say, well, he still could have had a gun in his waistband or whatnot. The point is that it was a piece of evidence for the jury to use in coming to their conclusion. So we do not believe that there's anything improper about that testimony. As far as his statement regarding Whitfield Harris, the defendant keeps basically saying that he was testifying to his opinion of Harris's thought process, which is simply not the case. He testified to what Harris told him during their interview about what Harris's thought process was. The defendant's reply brief says that's a distinction without a difference, but we believe that's just flat wrong. I mean, the detective was testifying to a factual matter. He wasn't theorizing about, well, Harris thought, you know, might have thought this, and that's why he said that he thought he saw a gun initially. He's saying that's what Harris told him. So he wasn't offering his opinion on Harris's thought process. As far as the ineffective assistance of counsel arguments, the Krankel arguments, your Honor pointed out, as far as the attorney falling asleep, which is obviously inappropriate, he still had the assistance of another attorney. The attorney who presumably fell asleep testified or told the judge at the post-trial hearing that she fell asleep while during the playing of the defendant's custodial statement. So it wasn't at a critical juncture in the trial in a way that would have, you know, prejudiced the defendant, conceivably prejudiced the defendant in any manner. As far as the images, not introducing images of the victim with guns, that was obviously a strategic decision. If she had introduced those images, then the state would have introduced images of the defendant with guns. Now, maybe the benefit of introducing images with the victim of guns would have outweighed the damage to the defendant if the state had introduced the images, but the fact remains that was a strategic decision, which is
how is that a valid strategy decision, though, if, as opposing counsel points out, he admits he had a gun, he admits he shot, he's just claiming self-defense. So if he's admitting he has a gun, how is the fact that there may be pictures of him with a gun coming in, defendant with a gun coming in, how does that factor into a strategy decision?
Well, it depends on what the images show, if they were seemingly threatening in nature, you know, then it could have damaged the defendant. The counsel made that decision. You know, she felt that that was the correct decision to make, and it was a strategic decision, whether it was correct or not. As far as introducing James Mann's, or attempting to introduce James Mann's testimony, what Mann told the police did not comport with the defendant's own account of what had happened. So counsel felt that that would not have been a smart decision to attempt to introduce Mann's testimony. Again, it was a strategic decision. And as far as
we talk about the sentencing for a minute, the sentencing judge incorrectly believed the defendant had an adult criminal record when he did not. He had a juvenile record, but he had no adult criminal record. At a minimum, does the state concede this should be remanded for a new sentencing hearing because of that incorrect belief?
The state's position is that the judge's incorrect belief that he had a prior adult conviction didn't factor in a significant manner in the sentencing, because the judge basically focused on his extensive criminal record up to that, as a whole, up to that point, and didn't appear to place any particular weight on that.
The court stated at R1034 that the prior record was a significant aggravation.
Right. We're arguing that as a whole, because he had several juvenile convictions as well. And the trial court also did talk at length about the defendant's youth as a mitigating factor. So if the court had believed that he had this adult, which apparently the court did believe he had an adult conviction, but it would have obviously have been very close to when he had just become a legal adult, and the court felt that his youth was a mitigating factor. So the state argues that the court wouldn't have placed any particular emphasis on that adult conviction in its sentencing determination.
Thank you.
Mr. Finjack, did you want to make a final statement?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple.
Hold on one second, Ms. Cook.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. I know Justice Vaughn had a couple questions. I just want to make sure Mr. Finjack was able to close his argument if he needed to.
The last thing I was going to say about the Krankel argument is the defendant argued that the counsel was ineffective because she didn't move to suppress his statement, but his statement to his custodial statement didn't differ in any significant way from what he testified to at trial. So there would have, it basically was a moot point. There was no reason to suppress the statement. That's all I wanted to add.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Finjack. Now, before we move on to Ms. Cook, just to be clear, Justice Vaughn or Justice Barberis, do you have any final questions for Mr. Finjack?
I have no other questions.
I don't.
Okay. Thank you. Now, Ms. Cook, go right ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address the issue of Moore's testimony being a harmless error, because the evidence of the missing money, her testimony regarding the missing money, was simply cumulative of other evidence. I believe the prejudice that is in her testimony is because when Calvin testified about this dispute, he emphasized that although the dispute occurred, he held no grudge over it. It was a minor thing, and he had moved on from it. And her testimony served to contradict and discredit his, and to establish for the jury what was a potential motive for an attack. I would also like to turn to the issue about Cherry's mere presence not being prejudicial. One point I'd like to make is that a police officer is not like any other witness. In this case, we had nine teenagers testifying. His presence throughout the trial could have been intimidating to any of those witnesses. In addition, the idea that his narration of the video was helpful to the jury because jury members are not able to rewatch the video, I'm not sure that's the case. In this case, there were seven 30-second video clips, and I believe they were sent back to the jury during their deliberation, just like photos or any other exhibit. There's no reason to think that the jury would not have had time to rewatch the videos if they felt that would be helpful during their deliberation. The question about Cherry's testimony regarding Whitfield's thought process, if in fact what Cherry was saying was he was merely remarking about what Whitfield told him was his thought process, that is still inadmissible hearsay. If it was important to the state's case to admit that portion of Whitfield's custodial interrogation, they simply could have played that clip from his own recorded interrogation, rather than have Cherry provide this hearsay testimony about what Whitfield told him he was thinking. Next, on the ineffective assistance of counsel argument, the issue of James Mann, counsel stated that his remarks to the police would not have comported with Calvin's account. At this point, we do not have a full account provided from James Mann. We have merely a cursory statement in a police report. It's difficult to know just based on that what his full story might have been. But his account as relayed to the police was that he heard more than one type of gunfire, which certainly would support Calvin's account of also hearing multiple gunshots, return fire after he fired. And finally, the argument that there was no reason to suppress his statement. Calvin's statement went on for 2 hours and 44 minutes of the jury watching him in an interrogation cell. At the beginning of the recorded statement, it's clear that he's struggling to focus. He had the detectives were asking him, are you on some kind of drugs? It's clear that he is not at his best, and simply watching this statement certainly was prejudicial to his defense. And that's all I have, Your Honors. If there are any other questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. Justice Barberis or Justice Vaughn, any final questions?
Nothing for me. Thank you.
None.
Well, counsel, thank you for your argument today. Obviously, we will take the matter under advisement. We will issue an order in due course.